Anyway, I'd like to thank Santiago and the Fields Institute for hosting this workshop. This will be the first presentation from the industry and the only presentation from the regulators. Obviously we were not as busy as OSFI. I would never miss an opportunity for a dialogue between the academia and the industry, because I think it's very important that we carry forward the knowledge, the model, the theories developed in the academic side to the industry correctly, because otherwise we run the risk that it is lost in translation. This presentation is not based on a paper, so you will see that I plagiarize liberally. I would also prefer this to be very interactive, so if you have any questions, don't wait till the end, just ask it anytime you like. So as someone from the regulatory agency, of course, the usual disclaimer applies. These are not the official positions of the OCC. These are just my personal views as a researcher and an expert on this in this field. What I would do is briefly go over the requirements, because I know that we have a very heterogeneous crowd here, so the bankers would know these requirements very well. So bear with me for a few minutes till I go over this, and I will also focus on the challenges that we face as supervisors in validating these models or assessing these models, and also I will touch upon some of the difficulties faced by the industry. As you know, Basel II is a new regulatory regime which will require banks to significantly change the way that they calculate regulatory capital. It has already been implemented in Canada and Europe. In the United States, we are in a period in which the institutions are implementing internally, but the result has not been made public yet. And generally speaking, for operational risk, there are three options available, at this workshop we focus on the advanced measurement approaches, which is banks' own internal risk-based models when they calculate their operational risk capital. The Basel II does not stipulate any specific approach, unfortunately for us, fortunately for the institutions. Unfortunate for us in a sense that it is real difficult to assess the models. Like, we have in the United States maybe 12 to 11 Basel II institutions depending on the mergers and acquisitions, so it's tough to keep count. But every time you go to an institution, you have a different model. So you have 12, 11 different models, and you are in a position to tell, you are put in a position to really assess the accuracy of that model. And it's not a very easy task, because you don't have any benchmarks. As Matthias said, I mean, there is no standard approach being used. Everybody says that they are using, let's say, an LDA, but of course the devil is in the detail. There are very different ways of implementing an LDA based model. So what are the overall requirements? Even though it's not prescriptive, it needs to follow some minimum regulatory requirements. That is, it needs to be quantified at the same confidence level as the credit risk. So that is the 99.9 confidence level. This is, I think, unique, because you don't usually see some statistical quantiles prescribed in law. Like, finance is probably unique in that sense. You have the 99.9 quantile of an aggregate distribution hardwired into the law. Data requirements, at least 5 years of data. That's, very, very short, because you are potentially modeling a heavy-tailed process. And we all know that if you, look at the actuarial world, I don't think that they will be satisfied with 5 years. But On the other hand, they have very long time series of data. If you look at catastrophe insurance, they have 100 years of hurricane data that they can rely upon. So this is, I think, the worst of the best option. I mean, what do you call statistics without any data, right? So at least you have 5 years of data. It will help you to start the analysis, but obviously for the really, really sub-exponential processes, it won't be sufficient because you'll have some institutions that realized extreme losses over the last 5 years, and some won't. So you're going to get very different capital results based on that chance. It needs to capture potentially severe tail events. Okay. Now, with 5 years of data, if you haven't realized any extreme losses, how do you capture potentially severe? How do you capture the tail? And because of that, the rule requires them to use four elements, internal data being one of them, external data being the other one. That is where, you know, data consortiums like ORX or others come into play. Then there's scenarios and BEICFs. I don't remember what this stands for. Internal and business environment and internal control factors. As quants, we rarely, I mean, I wouldn't even review this because it is not my expertise. For scenarios, it is the bank's own business expert's opinion or expert judgment of what the tail looks like. Now, obviously, you can't go to a workshop at a bank and ask people to estimate what the 99.9 quantile of that loss process is. I mean, I don't think the human brain is wired to work in that way. If you ask me, I wouldn't be able to answer that either. So there are ways of generating or soliciting that information from the business managers and so-called experts, but the difficulty is actually incorporating that into the quantification framework. And I think it will be talked in this workshop, I think, tomorrow or today. Yes. It says minimum 5 years, but in a sense, it says whatever history you have, you use all of them. Pardon me? Yeah, these models need to be approved by the regulators before they can be used. That's a very good question, though. I mean, you obviously reduce the standard errors, but unfortunately, when you look at the industry, you will see that the standard errors is not a very big player. I mean, you look at the point estimates, and usually there is no confidence band around those point estimates. And I think that is huge for model uncertainty. All right. And granularity of the model. I believe that granularity is a word used by the U.S. final rule, which is the U.S. implementation of the Basel II. Basically, what it says is that you have very large banks. We are talking about banks like Citi, JP Morgan Chase. So they have very different underlying processes, and you can't just lump them up. I mean, you need to find your homogeneous segments before you model them. So this is basically what it tells, that it needs to be, the model needs to be sufficiently granular given the bank size and business model. And some known facts about operational loss distribution, that operational loss data, which is actually, if you read any empirical article written on operational risk, you will see that at the introduction they will have this part, that they are heavy-tailed, they are highly skewed, and that have special dependence characteristics. And I'll explain what I mean by special in a few minutes. And the data exhibits heterogeneity. Even if you have a very granular model, still, given the lack of data, you have the risk of trying to modeling very different processes in one model without knowing it. And as we all know, extreme caution must be taken when modeling heavy-tailed processes, because some of the results are really counterintuitive. Here's an example. This is actual data that was collected by the Basel Committee. This is LDC 2008. Let me give you a brief introduction of what this is. The Basel Committee collected operational loss data from about 100 banks globally. And here you will see the distribution of the operational losses. And the column that is really the most interesting one is the second from the last. If you look at the bottom, you will see that we collected about 10 million operational loss events. So huge data set. And if you look at the row right above it, 41 of the 10 million losses account for a third of the aggregate loss. It is extremely heavy tail, as you can tell. Okay, I will digress a little bit and I will talk about how we approach model risk. We know that all models are wrong, because a model is by definition an abstraction of the reality, right? It's based off of assumptions. And the usual way of going forward when you do modeling is that if you look at the textbooks, statistical textbooks, you choose a structural model and then you take that model as given. And when you look at model uncertainty, your analysis is conditional on that model being correct. So if you consider a model to consist of two parts, let's say S representing the set of structural assumptions, and then, of course, then you have the parameters whose meaning is specific to the chosen structure. And there are two ways of looking at models. Well, you can say that models are representative or representation of what is going on. So we are talking about structural models that summarizes a theory. For models like that, the model uncertainty will be lower because it's based off of a theory. Another way of looking at models is as a description of data, or sometimes it's called data mining. Right. Here, where you have the most uncertainty about the models. Unfortunately, operational risk models fall under this second characterization of a model. Right. You have data, then you fit severity and frequency distributions of data, and there is a lot of uncertainty about which type of severity distribution explains the underlying process. And there is a lot of uncertainty about the assumptions of those models. And this is even before we start talking about dependence. And let's see. So the main source of uncertainty in the model building is, first of all, model uncertainty, uncertainty about the structure of the model. What if LDA does not apply? I mean, because you are not looking at any alternatives. Like, because in economics, when you look at models, you have very well-defined set of equations that explain the underlying theory. Like if you look at the transfer mechanism of monetary policy, for example, in macro. I mean, I apologize, I'm an economist by training, so this wouldn't mean much to a lot of you, but at least there is less uncertainty about that. And parameter uncertainty is probably the standard way of looking at model uncertainty. Basically, you look at your standard errors of the parameters that go into the model. And but still, even given the model uncertainty and the parameter uncertainty, you will still have unexplained random variation in the observed variable. I mean, even when you know the underlying structure of the model, and the parameters are well specified. So as you can see, there are layers and layers of uncertainty about the process. And here, within this context, you are using models to set capital, regulatory capital for financial institutions. So you need to be very extra careful when you assess these models. Here's an example that I like quoting. This is Joseph Cassano, head of AIG Financial Products Division. As we know, that division is being run off at this point by the government. Here, Joseph says that he can't really think of a scenario where they would lose a single dollar in any of those transactions. Those transactions are the highly structured products that his unit was underwriting on behalf of AIG. And those are the transactions actually that made AIG lose hundreds of billions of dollars. And you know what, at the end, I think the Bloomberg article was very, very interesting. At the end, actually, majority of the transactions were profitable. I think that division has close to 200,000 contracts, derivative contracts, and only 200 of them lost money. But when they lost money, they did lose money. And that was the problem. So here, in a sense, you got to be very careful. If you are, because I'm assuming, this guy has experience in model building, or he has experience in uncertainty. So, I mean, when you make claims like that, you have to be a little bit careful. And if you look at the literature, especially 2-3 years ago, I mean, it's very easy to find statements like this. In the context of banking and supervision, model risk, especially model risk pertains to the risk of using a misspecified model, i.e., for example, a misspecified tail behavior. Right? What if your tail index is actually greater than one underlying process, but you misspecify as less than one? It has very different results, as you know. The use of erroneously calibrated models, actually, sorry, that example would be more relevant for the second one. And then overly broad interpretation of the models, because this is something interesting. You may have the perfect model, you may have the right model, but you may use it for the wrong purposes, right? There's nothing wrong with the Gaussian copula, for example. It's a neat theorem that explains dependence, right? But if you use it to value collateralized debt obligations, then you may have some issues with it. I mean, I would have some issues with it. Now, let's see how we approach the validation process. When we go to the banks, what we are looking for. Just a brief explanation, we regulators don't validate the models. It is the bank's own responsibility to have the models validated, either internally or, you know, by an independent outside party. In a well-defined validation process, you are not just looking at statistical testing, you are looking at, you know, a timetable for validation activities. If a model is validated after being put into production, it has no, I would say it has very diminished value, right? First you want to have it validated before actually using it. Who is responsible for validation? Identify those parties. I mean, there are instances where we went to an institution, we will ask people, you know, who is your validation team, they will say team A. We'll go to team A, and they will say, what are you talking about? The first time we heard about this model. Then they will say, oh, you should be team B. Because these are very large institutions, and they have, you know, multiple validation teams. And if you add all the PhDs together in, you know, any of these given banks, you will get more people than a, you know, a decent size department would have in any university. What kind of test and analysis will be performed? Because before you start the validation process, you need to have a very clear criteria about how you measure the success of that model and define what failure is and what actions you take if the model fails. And documentation and reporting of findings. Well, when you look at this, you will say, you know, duh, I mean, don't we all do these? These are very clear, you know, model building requirements. But unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. Because the incentive structure is such that, if you think about it, validation is not very sexy, right? If you are good at model building, why would you work for a validation team? Besides, it takes time. If you look at an AMA model, it may take 3 or 6 months to validate. So every time you change it, you don't have the luxury to wait that long to get that model validated. But nevertheless, these are just some of the examples that we have to deal with as supervisors. And what are the challenges? Both for the industry, and by industry I mean both bankers and the regulators, understanding the underlying assumptions and their appropriateness is very, very important. This is just what are the theoretical underpinnings of this model, and this is where the academia really helps us, and dialogue like these is very helpful. And the third point, the sensitivity analysis. Your models are as good as your weakest assumption. Stress that weakest assumption. What is the impact of that if you change that assumption a little bit? Sometimes it's huge. So what insight I get out of that? Challenges particularly for us, the regulators, as I mentioned at the introduction, the flexibility inherent in the rule creates a broad range of practice. It would be really nice if we knew the stochastic ordering of the loss models, like which particular aspects of the model determine the first order outcome, for example. Well, we know, as an example, we know the choice of the copula affects the capital number, but that's not the only one. The choice of the number of units of measures, the granularity of the model, affects the result. The choice of the severity distribution impacts the capital number. So which of these has the most important impact? And of course, it's a function of the model that is being used by the institution per se. So that's where it becomes very, very labor intensive to review all these models. And obviously, if we had credible benchmarks for operational risk, I mean, whoever develops this benchmark, I think that would be a very well-read article for everyone that has a stake in this in this area. So that would be extremely helpful. Because currently, when we go to banks, when we look at their capital number, the AMA capital number, if bank A's capital is greater than bank B's as a ratio, we are not in a position to say that bank A has more exposure to operational risk than bank B. Because as I said, there are too many moving parts. And here is an example. Here is the situation. This is from the LDC exercise again. It is the reported regulatory operational risk capital as a percentage of some of the variables that are being used. For North America, I don't know that much about the other regions. For North America, bear in mind that these capital numbers are the numbers that are voluntarily disclosed by the institutions. These are not necessarily approved by the regulators because we don't currently have any AMA model that has been qualified for Basel II purposes. as I said, all the institutions are either in the parallel run or about to start the parallel run, and after they finish the parallel run period, they will officially implement or disclose the Basel II numbers. Okay. Yes, Canada is not United States, right? Yes. I remember to take my passport with me. So, correction. And actually, the reason I said that is, you can easily change this label to United States of America because there are, I think, about 19 North American banks here. Only one of them is from Canada. So if you exclude Canada, it won't going to change the results. But obviously, for confidentiality reasons, we couldn't have a different column for Canada because it will be identifiable. That institution would be identifiable. So look at AMA institutions. I'm not interested in non-AMA institutions. So if you look at capital as a percentage of consolidated assets, the median is 49 basis points, 0.49% of assets, and the interquantile range is from 33 basis points to 80 basis points. You may think that that difference is not that significant, but in billion dollars, it is significant. You can have, let's say, for any given bank, Bank A, if you apply these ratios, you can have capital between, let's say, $5 billion to $30 billion. And obviously, for the operations managers and regulators, that difference is a very significant sum. So I will not go over the others, but the point I'm trying to make here is that you have a lot of dispersion, and that dispersion is not necessarily explained by the differences in the risk profile of these institutions. And we have to somehow find a way to really benchmark these results and be able to say, you know, that bank has more operational risk than the other one. That's why they have more capital. Yes, Alberto? Actually, I'm going to Europe in 2 weeks, and I was going to ask the same questions to them, because I really don't understand. I mean, I personally don't believe that the underlying exposure is that different. I mean, there are certain differences in, for example, clients, products, and business practices. The litigation environment in the United States is different than Europe and Japan, so you have differences there, but. I think that is mostly, this is my speculation, mostly explained by the fact that there is short time series of data, and the occurrence of tail events wasn't distributed, you know, evenly across regions. So over the last 5 years, I would say our institutions, the United American banks, were hit proportionally more than the others at the tail. I don't believe that they necessarily have more exposure to operational risk than the others. It would be nice if someone can prove that statement or disprove that statement, but doesn't really make sense. But when you look at the data, there is clear difference between Japan and the rest of the world, and also clear differences between, you know, North America and the other regions. But also, do we have anybody from Australia here? Okay, are you working for the Prudential Australia? Okay, then I can tell whatever I want. The way that the AMA is implemented also differs, because it's open to interpretation. In Australia, the models are mostly scenario-based, so that gives, I think, more flexibility or more leeway to the institutions when they implement these models. In United States, it is mostly data-driven. internal and external data. I mean, scenarios are being used, but mostly internal and external data driven. We will never allow, never say never, but we will not allow a U.S. institution to omit their own historical data from the calculation. Some tried. I mean, the arguments you will hear is that, okay, we had a loss of $5 billion last year, but we will never have it again because we have better controls now. That event will not happen. We fired the person who's responsible or whatever you think about it. But the point is, yes, that same event will not happen, but that doesn't mean that you have exposure to $5 billion events. Whatever that event may be, we don't know, but you have that exposure. So I think this boils down to that argument that, you know, you have infinite support for these models, and obviously the amount of money in the world is not infinite. Wish it were, but it isn't. So there is a boundary condition for operational disclosures, but when for all practical purposes, when you set that boundary condition sufficiently at a sufficiently high level so that your regulators will be comfortable with that condition, is you end up with similar results as if you haven't incorporated any condition at all. Because if you allow a bank to do that, they will tend to set a boundary that is way too low, maybe at the highest historical loss that they observed over the last 5 years. But I would say if you're going to use any condition, use your total shareholders' equity, right? Because for all practical purposes, if you lose above and beyond that, you are out of business. So as you see, it's not a very trivial exercise for both bankers and for us. Problem formulation, I think we can skip this part unless you have any questions. Basically, you have IID losses. It's a compound process. You know, if you need to model the frequency of the losses, then you need to model the severity of the losses. Then you get the aggregate loss for the equation at the bottom is the firm-wide aggregate loss, which will consist of all the, you know, aggregate losses at each unit of business. And this is more interesting. The schematic representation, now depending on the granularity of the model, you could have a multidimensional problem. Let's say if you use the Basel II definition of event type, classification of event type and business lines, you can have, for example, a 56-dimensional problem. That means for each of these, you will model the losses, then you will somehow aggregate them. The aggregation part is tricky. Well, the rule requires that unless they have a reasonably justified dependence structure or dependence assumption, they have to sum them up. But again, you need to be a little bit sensitive to that because you don't want to penalize institutions that have a very granular model, right? Because if I know that I have to sum this up, then my incentive would be perhaps, sometimes the results are counterintuitive, but just hypothetically, my incentive would be to have as low number of units as possible. And that's not something we support. Operationalist models could broadly be classified as different variants of the loss distribution approach, which is the standard actuarial distribution-based models. There's a lot of academic material on this, and it's very well researched, I think. And you have extreme value theory and the approximate Ansicle formulas, the single loss approximation that Matthias was talking about on the second part of his presentation. Of course, all of these have its pros and cons, and as I said, it's very important to really understand the underlying assumptions and limitations of these models. A typical AMA building process will look like this. You pull the data, you fit the frequency, the aggregate distributions through convolution, I'm talking about, you know, mostly Monte Carlo simulation, then estimate your, you know, unit of measure level or business line level quantiles, then either add them or take a diversification benefit. Again, there is a lot of concern about this delta. And indeed, if it is indeed negative, then unfortunately, the rule specifies that the sum of the vars constitutes an upper bound, but maybe theoretically that's not true, right? Because if you want to somehow take into consideration systemic risk, it may make sense, but this is not an official position, personal position, it may make sense to have an extra charge for concentration if it is negative, right? Citibank comes to my mind, you know, an institution that size. So definitely more research needs to be done on this, and but currently, I mean, we assume that it is the sum of the vars constitutes an upper bound. Example with real data, okay. Just last week I was just playing with the data. Now here, just looking at one unit of measure, I think it's clients, products, and business practices in a retail business line in, you know, one of the US banks. The data is anonymized, so it's actually based on simulated data, but that data is built, that simulation is built off of that actual data set. The problem is, if you look at the theoretical distribution here, I mean, you have, let's say, I was able to find two distributions that fit well, log normal mixture and the Burr distribution, and they both fit well at the body of the distribution, and you can't really distinguish the tail, right? And then you, let's say, zoom in the tail, and you will see that they differ. But again, since it is above and beyond where you have internal data, you are extrapolating. How do you choose among these, you know, potentially very different sort of distributions? That, because that choice has significant impact on the capital number. Let me see how it. How do banks actually choose among these? One way of approaching this is that, okay, this is where internal data, this is as far as internal data gets us, let's say, right? Above and beyond that, we know we are extrapolating. So we have two distributions that fit well, but we have to choose among these. Obviously, we cannot choose the one that gives the higher capital number, because that capital number may be, let's say, 10 times more than the capital number that the other one is providing. And we can always choose the one that gives us the lower capital, because our supervisors will be very unhappy about that. So you need to have a criteria. One thing that some of the banks are using is the scenario analysis. They solicit this information from their business experts and compare the tails of these distributions to what their scenarios say. Not a purely scientific approach, not a very purely quantitative approach, but you look at, let's say, what is your quantile, 99.9 quantile of these two distributions, and what does your scenario say about that region? Not necessarily exactly that quantile, but that region, then you choose the one that is more in line with your scenarios. Or you can compare it to your external data. But again, it is highly judgmental. You know, modeling is part science, part art. Our responsibility is to make sure that the science part is dominant, and you don't have art without any science. CDFs are useless. They collapse, you know, in the region that you are really interested in. So I'll skip that. So as a toy model, the result you will get from these two third distributions is 122 million for the mixture log normal and 426 million for a Burr distribution. Again, this is just one risk cell out of potential 56 cells. So if you add these up, it will be a very significant difference. So why do we have such volatile capital estimates? Obviously, the extreme loss can cause a drastic change in the estimate of capital. Rare event prediction is typically very uncertain. You have very broad actual confidence intervals. Actually, I would love to see the confidence intervals around these capital estimates. Then you would be in a better position to say, or benchmark the institutions. So, and need significantly more data to reduce standard errors, but we don't really have the luxury to wait for 100 more years of data. I mean, when I go to a bank, actually, when I learn that they have a large loss, I usually get excited. Oh, you have more observation now, and you can do better modeling. This graph I borrowed from Guido's paper and Cope and Guido, so I hope you don't mind about that. So here, the point is, I think the red one is where they use all the data, and the green one is where you exclude the largest three losses. And when you exclude the largest three losses, your capital number, your capital result decreases from somewhere around $6 billion to $1.6 billion. Now, in any, generic statistical textbook, you will treat these as outliers and exclude them, right? But we are not interested in the central tendency here. We are not modeling the central tendency. But these outliers are precisely the observations that we are interested in. So, obviously, my position should be very clear from that statement. You can't exclude those observations, but then what do you do about them? And I think Guido will talk about that, right? You have some suggestions. Maybe go to a lower quantile. Dominance of the sums. Matthias talked about this already. So if you have a sub-exponential distribution, the theory says that the tail will be determined by your largest loss, right? More heavy tail distribution. So it may be just sufficient to actually concentrate on that one. So closed form approximation is used mostly for benchmarking purposes. I mean, there is only one institution that uses it as its main component of its AMA model, and obviously it underestimates capital. We are aware of those limitations of the approximation, and I think a few people are working on how to address those underestimation and the bias. But here, even if you control for these underestimation, one thing that I would highlight is that you are approximating the tail of your aggregate loss with the tail of your marginal, right? So in order to approximate the 99.9 quantile, if you, let's say, this is 99.9 quantile, let's say you have 100 beta, you will have to go to way, way in the tail of your marginal. And that's a problem. You better have a very good idea about what that severity process looks like or actually is. And that, given the uncertainty around that severity distribution choice, then you will get a very different result. I mean, I'm not just talking about the bias you get out of this anti approximation, but also model uncertainty you will get based on the severity distribution that you choose. Dependence. Well, we talk about diversification benefit, and actually I was presenting a paper at the Federal Reserve, and this is to people with market risk experience, and they said, what kind of diversification benefit are you talking about? I mean, where is the diversification here? You don't have two-sided support. You have one-sided support, and diversification in market risk refers to the fact that when you have a very well-diversified portfolio, your losses will be washed out by your gains. Now, where are the operational gains? Or what kind of diversification? Actually, maybe using the diversification is a misclassification here. We are not talking about actual diversification, right? Because the only diversification you get here is that when you have a large loss in one unit of measure, if there's a tendency to have a lower losses in the other units of measures, that's the benefit you get. But that largest loss is not diversified away by a large gain in another in other units of measure. So I think that was a very interesting comment on their side. Given that, given the time constraint, I'll go straight to the graphs. Two colleagues of mine at OCC has been working on a paper, and I'll just actually, before that, this is a very well-known fact from Embrecht and McNeil's book. Before I read it, I didn't know about this, that the correlation coefficient, you know, is between minus 1 and plus 1, but the practical correlations that you can get may be a subset of that. So that means if you have, under certain conditions, if your empirical correlation is 30%, that doesn't mean that you can take a diversification benefit of, let's say, 70%, because that may be the maximum linear correlation that you can actually observe given the distributions that you have for your severities. And here is an example where they have the standard log normal variable and the log normal variable. And as you see, the only time you will have a correlation coefficient, a positive correlation of 1, is that when these two variables are exactly IID, i.e. when they have the same mean and the same sigma. And if, let's say, holding the other variable as the standard log normal, if you increase the variance or standard deviation of the second process, you will see that the actual correlation you can observe will going to diminish. And after sigma greater than 0.4, theoretically it's not possible to observe a positive correlation. That doesn't mean that there is no dependence, though, right? We all know that. In all practical purposes, when you look at the data, the actual data, you will have, if it is log normal, the sigmas tend to be around 2.5, 2.6. So for those, let's see, you get maybe 20% observed correlation. That's your limit, theoretical limit. Yes, they do. They do. But to be very that the data is very limited, right? Because in order to estimate the empirical correlation, you will, let's say, look at the monthly aggregate losses, 5 years of data, you know, 60 observations. So what Halusi and Allman looked at is that if you look at the tail dependence and by using CoPLUS, and they show the impact of having a one-sided support. Now here's an example where you have a bivariate T-copula with the identical underlying T-marginals. And the way you look at this graph is that these are your sigma plus, U is your upper tail dependence, Sigma plus L is your lower tail dependence. So, and this sigma minus is also your tail dependence. But here, you know, positive large numbers will coexist with positive and negative numbers. So this is actually where you have diversification in the sense of market risk and credit risk. And this is where you don't have any diversification at all, positive dependence. And in this case, you see when you have a two-couple where you have both negative and positive tail dependence, you get some observations in the tail. But when you go to, let's say, one support, you'll see that those regions where you have negative tail dependence collapsed completely. So all you have is tail dependence, positive tail dependence. So in a case like this, what do you do? I mean, how do you calibrate that diversification benefit? Because before I think looking at these, you would have looked at, let's say, rank correlation, linear correlation, and try to come up with some level of calibration, let's say on average 20% correlation, then take your diversification benefit accordingly. But by looking at these, now you have a situation where it tells you that that doesn't really mean much. You need to really look at the tail dependence. And this, I mean, tail dependence is very well defined in, I think, Embrex's book. So these are the challenges. And it's, as I said from the beginning, model uncertainty is a significant concern. And you have very different models. I mean, for 11 institutions, 12 institutions, you have 11, 12 unique models. And benchmarking those, assessing the accuracy of those is what keeps us busy, or what has kept us busy the last 5 years and probably keep us busy for the next few years as well. Thanks.